Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 12th of June 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we're delighted to be joined today by Mark Anderson from American Free Press. And of course, Mark also runs the Truth Hounds blogspot with much good information. Where are we, Mike? Where are we in the world?
Well, it's getting increasingly hard to tell. So here we are, Theresa May. She's had all kinds of congratulations over the weekend. French President Emmanuel Macron called to congratulate the Prime Minister. Donald Trump called to congratulate the Prime Minister. Enda Kenny, she had a call with him and he congratulated her. Chancellor Merkel, she had a call with her and she congratulated Theresa May. And she spoke with the Australian Prime Minister Turnbull and the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Mr. English, and they congratulated her as well. So everyone was congratulating her over the weekend. It's spectacular. She must be feeling extremely comfortable. Then, of course, today she has to go and sit in front of the 1922 committee this afternoon, and that's at 5 p.m. And apparently, according to various news media, they will meet her with silence rather than banging the desk as they usually do.
I read part of that article, Mike, and in my mind I had, I have to say this, I had public schoolboys sitting with some tradition from their public schools as if they were entertaining the dinner lady to thank her for providing them with such excellent food throughout the term. This stuff has got to go. It's time, I think, to get rid of political parties because, of course, they just allow all this nonsense to happen.
So we captioned this "Giz a job" because we're not sure, of course, whether Theresa May will have her job for too much longer. The question is, how will that happen? Well, all it takes is for a certain proportion of Tory MPs to write to the chairman of the 1922 committee, who's Graham Brady, expressing no confidence in Theresa May. And once that threshold, I'm not sure what that is, and I still need to check that, has been reached, then the 1922 committee announces the start of a leadership contest. If there's only one candidate, then that candidate would automatically become leader and therefore prime minister for as long as the so-called coalition with the DUP hangs together.
Well, I think what we're seeing, Mike, is that the old system of parties being elected on the basis of who the prime minister would be, that's old hat. You get the party elected and then you bring in whatever prime minister you think is the one.
Well, that is the way the British system works. It's not based on personalities, so it's not supposed to be. That's a modern innovation.
Okay, we can have a discussion on that.
Yeah. Okay, so let's look at who she has decided to push alongside her. Theresa May, bolstering her position with Deputy Prime Minister role for Damian Green, says the Yorkshire Post. So let's just see who all she has. She's got Damian Green, who is actually First Secretary of State, which is a kind of Deputy Prime Minister role. Hammond stays as Chancellor of the Exchequer. Amber Rudd stays as Home Secretary, Secretary of State for the Interior, despite only having, 300 votes majority in her own constituency. That's staggering that she's managed to keep that job. Boris Johnson, at the moment, is Foreign Secretary, but of course we know he's angling for the top job. David Davis remains in the role of exiting the European Union, which we're not going to do, so he's not going to succeed there. Michael Fallon remains Secretary of State for War. And Jeremy Hunt for health. Now, if we go down through this list, just in the list that the government published, the various new members of cabinet, what we have is Theresa May. Well, she was a Remainer. Damian Green was a Remainer. Hammond was a Remainer. Amber Rudd was a Remainer. Boris Johnson was for Brexit, but actually he was a Remainer because he only did that massive U-turn at the last minute. David Davis was for Brexit. Fallon was a Remainer, Hunt was a Remainer, David Lidington, who's the new Secretary of State for Justice and Lord Chancellor, he was a Remainer, Justine Greening was a Remainer, Liam Fox was for Brexit, Greg Clark was a Remainer, Michael Gove was for Brexit, Chris Grayling was for Brexit, Javid was a Remainer, Baroness Evans was a Remainer, David Mundell was a Remainer, Alan Cairns was a Remainer, Brokenshire was a Remainer, Priti Patel was for Brexit, Karen Bradley was a Remainer, David Gawke was a Remainer, McLaughlin was a Remainer, Elizabeth Truss was a Remainer. Andrea Leadsom was for Brexit. Gavin Williamson was for a Remainer. Jeremy Wright was a Remainer. Brandon Lewis was a Remainer. So that's the entire cabinet. We've got 24 Remainers and 6 Brexiteers. So how does that work?
So you're suggesting that they're not for Brexit, Mike?
I couldn't comment. I couldn't possibly comment on that. So, we can make our decision as to what happens at this point, but if the negotiations for Brexit are going to start in the next few days, we're not really in a very strong position for getting out, are we?
Unless the plan was never to come out in the first place.
Absolutely. So just remind ourselves what Damien Green, the Deputy Prime Minister, has said in the past. When you have an absolutely overwhelming consensus that there are huge risks and potential huge damage from leaving, then we should take that seriously.
Right.
So he doesn't want to leave. Not too many of the cabinet wants to leave. Theresa May doesn't really want to leave.
Perhaps we should ask for an American opinion on this situation. Mark, are you there? And give us a little bit of help, because politics in Britain at the moment becoming unbelievably confused, with the people who say they want to come out of Europe, full of people who want to stay in Europe. But what's your view from the other side of the pond?
Well, I was picking up a copy of the Financial Times, which might as well be called the Bilderberg Post in many respects. I picked it up at Baltimore Airport, and the headline is "May Clings On After Poll Disaster with Pro-EU Forces Set to Strike." And I added some words to the headline: conveniently and predictably, May clings on with EU forces set to strike as planned. I added those words to the headline, scribbling with my pen. Kind of a humorous thing. It's a way to pass time on the airline. But at any rate, excuse me, a couple of problems here. There's a quote right in the front page story: "The hung parliament has thrown the fraught Brexit process into question, with one minister saying that Mrs. May will now find it impossible to push through the mountain of legislation needed to smooth Britain's exit." Excuse me. "In practical terms, Brexit is dead," this minister said.
Wow.
So, pardon me, I had a slight technical problem, but you actually have those words on the front of the Financial Times calling Brexit dead. And that's
the Bilderberg Post.
Yeah, the Bilderberg Post. Yeah. And the Economist wasn't much better, saying in perfect unison the same basic things, that now they're going to have to go for a soft Brexit. There's these words like you guys are familiar with: hard exit, soft Brexit, excuse me, all these terms: hard Brexit, soft Brexit. But then you got people chiming in calling Brexit seriously wounded or virtually dead. And it looks like they call this election, they're basically saying they called this election early, right? Theresa May didn't have to call this election right away. She could have waited. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right.
Well, it looks to me like, with an American's perspective, that this was all set up. She knew what the reaction would be if she called it early. She knew that the Conservative Party and herself would deflate. And then they could say, oh, this is all beyond our control. We didn't see this coming. But in fact, then they knew that new coalitions and new voices would step in to fill the void and to begin to call Brexit either comatose or dead. That's my American quick take on it.
Yeah. So we've got a deliberately contrived situation in order to make sure that Britain does not exit from the European Union. And of course, UK column has been saying for months and months and months that the whole idea of Brexit was a complete scam. Well, brace yourselves, because, of course, this is the man who is now heading the polls to become the new prime minister. I don't know whether this is part of his political opinion, the picture, or not, but we better put an end to Boris, prime minister to be. I'm just still stunned that so many people think that this man is a buffoon, that he's a little bit silly, a little bit funny. Because in my opinion, this man is extremely dangerous, both politically and perhaps in some of his other affairs. And he simply hides under the buffoonery but we've got a potentially very dangerous person to come in here. Mm. The only thing I will ask you, Mark, is it true that he shares the same hairdresser as Donald Trump?
Evidently so. Or maybe the hairdressers know each other or went to the same beauty school or something, to add a little humor to our banter here.
Yes.
But evidently so.
Okay. Clearly, neither of them have encountered a comb. But let's come into the serious stuff here, which is the fact that if we go back, we can start to see exactly what the Conservatives were putting together. So this is part of the UK column report from May 2013. So the nudge unit was to become a business, and this is the government's applied behavioural psychology unit. At that stage, they were very confident they could change the views and values of the general public by using politically applied behavioural science. And they were so confident that it would work that they then sold the programme on. And America and Australia were two of the first countries to buy the technology. The unit's now become a social enterprise, so it's now been pushed out more to the commercial side of life. Nevertheless, the whole thing was born inside the political system. So let's have a look at this. Again, it has only been the UK column that has actually described how all of this propaganda machine was put together inside of the Tory party. Let's see if we can focus in on some of this. Well, some of the names have changed. Gus O'Donnell, Bob Kerslake came in after him. But we had David Cameron there. We had Francis Maude working very closely, both with Gus O'Donnell, Jeff Mulgan and Julia Middleton of Common Purpose. And of course, Common Purpose given the job of training the top 200 civil servants. But this is where we really started to warn people, because we showed that in the background, Cameron had brought in the French expert Oliver Willier. That was the man who was just on screen. And he was working closely alongside Dr. David Halpin, who was heading up this behavioral, so-called behavioral insights team. This is a propaganda applied behavioral psychology unit straight inside Parliament. Or within Westminster. And it had already tried out its applied behavioural psychology on departments inside the government, of which DEFRA was the first one where they used this technology on their own staff in a £34 million programme. So let's put some more of the pieces together. This was a key part of David Cameron's Alinsky Big Society. This man, Mr. Way, stepped down, so we're going to cross him out from the programme. But of course, this was the heavyweight that was actually driving the whole of the big society and the third, so-called third way. Eric Pickles, as Manford Community, who described himself as revolutionary and said that the Conservatives were going to shake up the British government. So when we look at the election, and we need to pay attention to these sorts of organisations like the People's Assembly that, of course, brought in the immensely successful video, She's a Liar, Liar. And what did that do? Well, that helped bring in this massive youth vote that helped swing the election more in favour of Labour. So we can put within the Conservative administration a massive propaganda exercise which was designed to manipulate any election, whichever way they felt.
Must be the Russians behind all that, though.
It was surprising. I didn't find any connections with the Russians in the work that we did and have done since, Mike. But now let's look at the angle here, because in comes the Times. So having motivated all these young people to believe that Corbyn was the solution, what does the Times now do? Well, it attacks them and says, well, we shouldn't really pay attention to any of these young people at all. So this is more confusion. But of course, ultimately, it's going to undermine younger people and any political opinion. So that produces the apathy. So let's come back to the future prime minister. And by a remarkable coincidence, a WhatsApp that he sent is leaked. So what sort of thing does this say? Well, a lot of it is sort of rather good conservative advice. She won more votes than anyone since Margaret Thatcher. I can't remember having anything like 43% of the vote. We've got to stop the narrative that Corbyn somehow won this thing. He barely did better than Gordon Useless Brown when we beat him in 2010. We must get on and deliver for the people of this country, including a great Brexit deal. And this one caught my eye. We must not allow the media to spread mischief, not least because the public are fed up to the back teeth of politics and politicians, and they certainly don't want another election. So I think what we're now really seeing is the meat of the Lib Lab con. And what's the objective here? It's to totally confuse the political situation so people have no idea what's going on at all.
Of course, while the political situation remains confused, people are distracted from what's going on with Brexit.
Indeed. Now, if you're asking what has that actually done for us, what has the general election bought? What we say that the general election has bought is time, because we can be sure that we're going to see in Westminster a box of rats squabbling, arguing, stabbing each other in the back. And that gives us time to expose what's really going on. Mm. And I think he did get a mention just now, which is Michael Gove returning to the cabinet. Here we are, soft Brexit. So, Mark, you're absolutely right with your analysis from the States on whether Brexit was hard, soft or non-existent. And some of that picked up in the Times here. So I think we're allowed just to put this on screen. The correct word is mayhem. Soft Brexit, well, maybe, we don't think so. Brexit is a lie and always was.
Well, I had a look on the what was going on Twitter today, and I came across this from David Jones, a Leave campaigner, 90,000 followers on Twitter or so, apparently. And he said, David Davis says the UK is leaving the single market. Any attempt to keep us in will lead to big civil unrest. And that intrigued me because I wasn't certain who was saying what in this tweet. It implies that David Davis had said that any attempt to keep us in would lead to big civil unrest. So I went to the Radio 4 Today programme interview with David Davis to check. And of course, he said nothing of the kind. So this is basically David Jones' comment conflated with what David Davis has said, a bit disingenuous, perhaps. But it's the sentiment, nonetheless, is somewhat worrying, Brian, that any attempt to keep us in the single market will lead to big civil unrest. This is the aim.
This is the next phase, Mike, which is this Lib Lab con. These parties working together are desperate to get violence and proper civil unrest on the streets, because if they can achieve that, they can have their dictatorship in one simple step. So they are going to use any and every means possible to create this chaos and violence. And this is why we continue to say that anybody pushing for violence of any form on the streets is just falling into the trap.
So let's just have a quick reminder of what we said on Friday, what was coming next. A likely increase in terrorist events, not necessarily limited to the UK. That the intensity would rise in the UK at least to a level where a government of national unity is justified. And I'm hearing over the weekend lots of calls for exactly that, perhaps beginning with a sort of a unity team for the Brexit negotiations. But nonetheless, the term government of national unity being bandied about is, like sweeties over the weekend, and all parties working to a common purpose, and possibly Operation Temper being invoked once again. Now, by coincidence, on Friday, and we didn't get a chance to cover this on Friday, but on Friday, the government produced the new version of its Crowded Places guidance. I can't imagine what they're expecting, that they might need to reissue this and bring it up to date. But there you go. It says the new Crowded Places guidance for the UK has been written by CTSO with the support of the Centre for Protection of National Infrastructure and over 100 subject matter and academic experts. It covers the key areas of protective security, including physical, personnel, personal and cyber. It provides guidance on how different sectors can act to help make their businesses, institutions and organisations safer. Its purpose is to support those who are charged with security at crowded places, mitigate the threat and make the UK less vulnerable to an attack. The guidance is interactive and designed to assist crowded place sectors assess the risk and build a security plan to help mitigate that risk and recover more quickly should there be a terrorist attack. So that came out just on time, just in time. Speaking about it, Lucy Dorsey said terrorist attacks are rare in the UK, but recent events have shown that an attack could happen anywhere and without warning. You'll notice that Lucy Dorsey's image is covered up there, Brian.
Is that for security?
It's not for security reasons. It's actually on copyright grounds because, Commander Lucy Dorsey, it's all rights are reserved on this image on the Metropolitan Police News website. I went to look for some contacts at the Met Police and their media team to see if I could get permission to use the image outside of the Met Police website. But when I went to the contacts page, this is what I got.
This will certainly be a counter-terrorism measure so that you can't actually contact the Metropolitan Police in case you're a terrorist.
Anybody listening to this on Alternate Current Radio or on the podcast, basically the contacts page has no contacts on it.
Right.
So you cannot contact the Metropolitan Police media team at this point in time for some reason.
But I have to say, Lucy has also got the same blonde hair that Boris Johnson and Trump's got. So maybe she's part of it.
Quite possibly. It looks like the Tory party heading for more U-turns because David Davis, as we mentioned, was on Radio 4 this morning. He said, we have been given an instruction by the British people. We have to carry it out. That means that some elements of the manifesto will be pruned away. I thought people were elected on the contents of their manifesto, Brian.
Not. And of course, we remember that it was Cameron that started to remove material from the Conservative website, which showed where they had failed to carry out what had been in previous manifestos. That was something which at the time they were accusing North Korea of censoring the media. And here was Cameron doing the same thing.
So David Davis was then asked, what kind of things would be removed from the manifesto, and he said he wasn't going to prune it on air. So there you go. We don't know what's going to happen, but basically
he's going to prune it in secret behind closed doors.
Absolutely, but basically what they're saying is they're not going to abide by the manifesto that they were all elected on. Okay, so let's move on then to propaganda and the British Library. So the British Library has decided that beginning today, they're going to run a course. Participants can join at any time up until the end date, which is Sunday, the 23rd of July, 2017. It's a free online course. It introduces learners to current thinking and research and propaganda from political, historical, cultural and other perspectives. And in this course, you will discuss your own political values, how you express them and how you identify political beliefs in the world around you. And through films, presentations and online discussions, you can explore the different ways in which people perceive concepts such as freedom, law, identity, belonging and personal choice. This has been developed by the University of Nottingham's Centre for the Study of Political Ideologies. It's in partnership with the British Library and it's presented by an organisation called Future Learn. So there you go. They're running a course on propaganda. Well, in fact, you don't need to do this course, or at least you wouldn't need to do this course, if you had been at the Media on Trial event last night in Frome. Really well run and well attended event. But run by Frooms.war. So well done to Sheila and the team. It was a packed hall spectacular. They got everything going more or less on time. It ran on time. Had a fantastic question and answer session at the end. Really the media ended up really pretty much being found guilty.
Right. And you had some mainstream media people there as well, Mike.
There were some mainstream media people in the audience and a couple of quite good questions coming from that direction in the Q&A at the end.
So can we take a guess that the mainstream media wanted to get some people in to see what was being said about them, basically?
No, I think the people that were there were genuinely interested.
Right.
But it was a massively successful event. We've got some video that'll be coming out in the next couple of days, so people will be able to watch the presentations.
Yeah, excellent. Well, let's have a change of subject, and then we can bring Mark Anderson in. I spotted this in the Irish Times, and it just fascinated me. This is a story which says that Cork City population is going to be expanded by 100,000 under new scheme. And in the article, it said that the city would expand to include Douglas, Donnybrook, Grange, Frankfeld, Field, Rochtown and other places, including Cork Airport. And the councillor, Councillor Mr Cahill, said that the extension was the correct solution for a new model of local government for Cork. A healthy and independent city is critical to drive economic growth and the wealth of the region. I immediately thought, well, what this is propaganda for the city state, which, of course, we've been talking about for some time. And I understand, Mark, you've been taking part in, or at least listening to what's been said in other locations about the rise of the city state.
That is true, Brian. The Chicago Council on Global Affairs, as I've mentioned on yours and other news shows recently, had their annual Global Cities Forum, June 7 through 9. And Ivo Dalder, an American who used to be the U.S. ambassador to NATO, is the president of that Chicago branch of Chatham House, connected through the New York CFR. And he said in his opening statements, June 7th, that it's time for the cities to challenge the nation state politically, to challenge the nation state head on about climate change. By implication, also about immigration and border security laws, implying in some respects that cities, global cities, as he put it, would become sanctuary cities for illegal aliens, at least by default, if not by design on that point. So the One Worlders are being very explicit now, more so than last year when I covered the Chicago group. They're being very explicit about directly challenging the supremacy and the sovereignty of the nation state in terms of determining policy and moving forward. They're becoming much more strident in their language.
And so what were the sort of main subjects for discussion on this, Mark?
Well, I actually, unfortunately, didn't get a chance to peruse the whole list, having been busy with a different project over the weekend, partly wrapping up Bilderberg, and tons of photographs and video clips that I had to go through. Essentially, though, the main thrust of it is, like last year, the dependable things you can say about it is that while they talk about what you and I might consider, you know, understandable or useful advances in infrastructure in our cities to make the cities function better in terms of transportation, in terms of communication and everything being, of course, deeply embedded in the internet and surveillance capabilities, the aesthetics, the way the cities are laid out. Not all of this is necessarily bad on its face, but what the undercurrent of the whole thing is that cities need to be the prime determiner, if you will, the prime thrust in determining policy, even at a national level. And as we've described, the Bilderberg-blessed idea in terms of being favorable to the Bilderberg group and their other related groups is to have all the cities network together in a kind of worldwide grid and to make demands upon and challenge the supremacy of the nation state and erode the nation state from the bottom up while the rest of us often look from the top down. And before, that's always the thrust of it, whatever the individual topics might be. There were go on. That's basically it.
Yeah. So I was just going to say, so what you're describing here is a network of cities, which, believe that they should be providing, governance to the world, and that basically they will run their own policy agenda, no matter what, so-called democratically elected governments might say.
Yeah, I even use the word the cities want to secede. It's almost like a form of policy secession from the nation state. I used that word on a radio show based in Switzerland over the weekend, and the host didn't object to that. He thought that that was at least virtually an accurate term. Maybe it's not a full removal from the nation state, but it's certainly trying to devolve all the power to the local level. Now, some of us might look at that and say, what's wrong with that? Why not have less centralization? But they're really just reorienting this thing and flipping it around. And you might say re-centralizing the power at a different strata, at a different level. So it looks like less central control and more local control, but it's really just another way of operating a centrally controlled worldwide grid by the elite. They're just reorienting it, in my opinion, based on what I've seen so far. And it certainly fits into the Bilderberg strategy going back to at least 2014 when Bilderberg met in Copenhagen, Denmark. And Global Cities was, according to my inside sources and some of the Bilderberg announcements, both Global Cities was a big explicit topic and a kind of unofficial topic as well at that Copenhagen meeting. So just like the global tax thing has carried over from Bilderberg in 2013, the Global Cities thing is carrying over from Bilderberg in 2014. And then the Global Affairs Council in Chicago and similar groups, their job is to take these more secretive Bilderberg topics or semi-secretive and actually then begin to parade them out in front of the local officials, the mayors, the city councilmen, the general population, and then kind of give popular consent, or at least the appearance of popular consent, to these ideas that were, sort of incubated at Bilderberg and then brought out in that way.
What Mark's just described sounds like globalized big society.
Globalized big society, absolutely. And of course, remember, is each city state gets its mayor, the whole power of the city state is under the direct control of one person with their cronies. But a question, Mark, obviously you've seen this agenda coming through the Bilderbergers, but the United Nations is also a key source for this type of material. And we've known for some time that United Nations policy seems to be coming straight into the UK and straight into the civil service, the public sector, without necessarily even being rubber stamped by government. How would you describe the relationship between the UN and the Bilderbergers? Are Bilderbergers driving the UN?
That's a tough question. Of course, the UN was created in 1945, if memory serves. Boy, I hope I don't get my history wrong. It's a little early over here. I barely remember what I did an hour ago in some respects, but I would say the UN is sort of not under the direct influence of the Bilderbergers. I think they're birds of a feather. I think they share in a lot of the same ideological ideas. You know, the Agenda 21 of yesterday and the Agenda 2030 of today is seen by many as comporting with or aligning with Bilderberg's chief goals. And the city states seem to fulfill the Agenda 2030 outlook, which is getting more and more people into the cities, and controlling the countryside, controlling agriculture, controlling transportation and where people go, and really kind of sequestering people in cities. The talk at the Chicago thing this year at the Chicago Council meeting on global cities was how many more people, and isn't this a good thing, they say, that increasingly large parts of the population are living in the cities. More and more people are being born in the cities, born to city life. And they seem to be saying that the city life is our destiny, and that rural living will become much more relegated as a thing of the past and less significant. And that does fulfill, in general terms, the Agenda 2030 of the UN. And that's more people into cities and the countryside protected from human activity more and more. This is why U.S. national parks are declared World Heritage Sites by the UN. And people see that as expanding to where rural life and country life will be hyper-regulated, water supplies will be tightly controlled, transportation tightly controlled, more people living and working in cities. And that's the vision that we're told is a spontaneous democratic choice, when in fact the world managers through Agenda 21, through Agenda 2030, through the Global Cities Movement, they're planning that future for us in most respects.
Yeah, that sums it up. They are planning this future for us. So this is not something that's being debated openly in order to make sure that we're fully informed as to what the plans are. They debate it because we're too silly to really understand it, Mike.
Well, for a bit of background on this, get onto the UK Column website, have a look at the One World Governance series of articles, and also have a look at the Global Parliament of Mayors and the... can't remember the second half of the headline, but search for a Global Parliament of Mayors. Because just as a final remark on this, Mark, of course, once the Global Parliament of Mayors is established, they had the first meeting in November last year, but once it's established as a regular thing, this is a new government institution, which, as we've mentioned, is out with any governance of the nation state.
That's right. Pretty much beyond the reach of members of parliament, pretty much beyond the reach of members of the U.S. Congress. So, you know, it fits the Bilderberg credo of creating a kind of private government, a parallel government to the normal nation state. And then they rent the nation state's armies when they need someone to do some kneecapping or topple a leader or seize oil supplies or other energy supplies. Then they'll rent or lease your army or mine. But other than that, they operate on this quasi-independent track that really is the outcome of all these 65 years of Bilderberg, and that's private government. They're even privatizing government itself, not just privatizing, say, water supplies or utilities or what have you. That's always been my opinion, and it seems to be fleshing out.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, a nice little lead in there, Mark, because you mentioned sort of the use of the military. We were just fascinated to be past this headline from the Times. It said that the UK will be forced to quit top NATO role. And according to this story, they say a British officer has held the key role of Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe for much of the period since it was created in 1951. But experts say it's now very likely that Britain will have to relinquish the job because of Brexit. Sources close to NATO say France wants the role, although Germany is also expected to lobby for it. Now, this is a very interesting headline. What's the Ministry of Defence done? Well, they've come out extremely hard and said there are no plans whatsoever to change this deputy post from being a British officer. The military committee is NATO's highest military authority, and the chairman of the alliance is senior military officer, and the chairman of the alliance is senior military officer. The nomination of the chief of the defence staff for election to the role demonstrates the UK's unwavering commitment to the NATO alliance and its standing within it. Now, I've put there that this is the same MOD that lied over the real purpose of defence cuts, and of course those cuts were to help Britain's military to be subsumed into full EU military unification. That is happening apace. It's happening as we speak. And of course, Mike, you also pointed out that the Ministry of Defence didn't want to tell the truth about British troops in Syria. So I don't think the Ministry of Defence is telling the truth over this one. It is obvious that as Britain's armed forces have been cut smaller and smaller and smaller in order to build the European military structure, that at some point the French and the Germans would say, well, in fact, we represent the Europe rather than UK.
Well, Michael Fallon had this to say: the fact that Britain holds such a senior military role underlines our leading role in NATO, with recent commitments of to 500 troops in Estonia, more troops in Afghanistan, the renewal of our nuclear deterrent. We've never been more committed to the NATO alliance, and on the basis that as Secretary of State for War, he generally lies through his teeth, we've got to assume that his commitment isn't to NATO, it's to EU military unification, and the EU will become the major power bloc within NATO.
Indeed, and of course he mentions 500 troops there as if this is a major deployment, which of course it is within the troop levels that we've currently got. So British Army dropped to around 82,000 men maximum. 500 troops is seen as a major deployment by Mr. Fallon. Let's remind the nation while we have the opportunity of speaking about him that of course his specialism is nothing to do with defence or the military. It is in fact running children's nurseries. So probably 500 children in his mind, Mike, would be the problem. But this is reality. So under the smokescreen of the election, this report is that a B2 has landed at RAF Fairford. And I just find this very, very interesting that, of course, the whole of UK's media over the weekend was all tied up with post-election analysis. And then we've got what I would call a major US asset coming into RAF Fairford. And what's it going to be doing? Well, according to a spokesperson, the B2 regularly conducts strategic bomber missions that demonstrate the credibility of the bomber forces to address a global security environment. Do you understand what that means?
No.
No. Mark, that quote was by an American, so I think we should come over to you to interpret it for us. I apologise for catching you on the hook, on the hop there.
I think Mark is not with us at
the
moment.
He's not with us at the moment.
No. Okay.
All right. Well, my point was, I think what we're looking at on screen is American transformational newspeak. So what does that quote mean? We really don't know.
Well, today is World Day Against Child Labour. This is United Nations exercise once again. They say globally over 1.5 billion people live in countries that are affected by conflict, violence and fragility. At the same time, around 200 million people are affected by disasters every year. A third of these are children. A significant proportion of the 168 million children engaged in child labour live in areas affected by conflict and disaster. And they talk about this as if conflict and disaster, well, conflict anyway, is just something that happens naturally. Disasters, perhaps, natural events in most cases. But conflict, never a natural event. And in fact, I suppose Britain, mainly responsible for quite a lot of the conflict, with a few others perhaps, but Britain, one of the major drivers of conflict around the world. So we should pay attention to this. The World Day Against Child Labour this year will focus on the impacts of conflicts on child labour. And so they are holding an event today to mark the World Day Against Child Labour. And then that's going to be followed up with a conference, the Global Conference on Child Labour, which is going to take place in Buenos Aires in November this year, because we need a global conference to promote this type of thing. Child labour is, of course, one of the things that's holding the global economy up at the moment. So without the conflict that we are generating and the child trafficking and labour that comes out of that, Western corporations would be in a bit of difficulty.
Indeed, I expect Mr. Corbyn will be on to this in due course, Mike.
You think so?
No.
Okay. And just briefly to end then, Theresa May may have had her problems, but President Macron doesn't seem to be having any problems at all, because, of course, the big question was what kind of parliament was France going to have with him as president, and who was going to be the equivalent of MPs in France. Well, it looks like he has won the first round of electing, or his party has. He is looking at a fairly large parliamentary majority. The socialists in France aren't doing so well. They're looking at the projection. The second round of voting, the final round of voting is on the coming Sunday, and it's looking like they are going to end up with somewhere between 15 and 40 MPs. They currently have 277 MPs in the French parliament. And Macron is going to end up with a significant number. He certainly doesn't seem to be looking at a hung parliament sort of being hamstrung in his ability to govern.
Am I right in saying, Mike, it's a bit academic anyway, because, of course, France isn't operating as a democracy at the moment, as they've extended the state of emergency to November, I think.
That is correct.
Yeah. So you go through the motions of life being normal in government, as if the public people have got a choice and can influence what's going on. But actually, you are a police state.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have we got Mark back in? We lost you, we think, for a moment.
Any final comments, Mark?
Yeah, there have been some technical problems. A quick answer to your thing on the agenda of the Chicago group. Their first program involved Martin Wolf coming fresh out of Bilderberg, Martin Wolf, the business writer for the Financial Times. and then the Financial Times co-sponsor, the Chicago Global Cities Forum, fresh out of Bilderberg, having met in Chantilly, Virginia. And the mayor of Toronto, Canada was there, the mayor of Rio de Janeiro.
And Dan, we've lost Mark again. So, right.
Okay. Well, it will have been Russia, Mike.
It must have been.
So, Mark, unfortunately, you just cut off there. We'll put that down to the Russians. It's traditional to blame them for virtually everything that happens. I hope that whatever Macron does, he keeps his hands off our prime minister because he's quite keen on the more mature lady.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, we better end there. Serious times in UK, turbulence, but this is the opportunity for ordinary people now to realise that the political parties are all operating to the same common purpose. They need to be exposed. We need decent people back in Westminster. That's it for today. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.